From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! ...1,700 protesters are arrested at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. Police attack anti-fascist demonstrators in Madrid on the 25th anniversary of the death of dictator Francisco Franco. We'll speak with international brigadistas and guerrillas who fought against fascism in Spain. With 30 suitcases in Japan, Peruvian President Alberto Fujimori is set to resign. And Florida's Supreme Court will decide the next chapter in the vote saga. We'll speak with a news director and former cop who witnessed African Americans turned away at the polls. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of demonstrators marched slowly through the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia, yesterday to demand the closing of the Army School of the Americas, which trains Latin American soldiers. Critics blame the school for human rights abuses committed by some of its graduates. Police arrested 1,700 protesters, including actor Martin Sheen, about half the number that entered the West Central Georgia Post. An estimated 3,000 others continued the protest outside the gates. The annual demonstration commemorates the November 16, 1989 killings in El Salvador of six Jesuit priests, to which some of the school's graduates have been linked. We go now down to Fort Benning, Georgia, just outside the gates, where Father Roy Bourgeois is standing by. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Father Bourgeois.
Yes, good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Describe what happened yesterday.
Oh, incredible. We had thousands of people from all over the country, thousands of college students, parents with their children, veterans, people of faith from all over the country, gathered at the main gate of Fort Benning to call for the closing of the School of the Americas, as we see it, a school of assassins. We were here to keep alive the memory of thousands of people in Latin America who had been killed, tortured, raped, massacred by graduates of the school at Fort Benning, Georgia, the School of the Americas. And we were here, 10,000 strong, 3,500 went on to Fort Benning after the memorial service, and 1,700, as you mentioned, were arrested. It was just a wonderful celebration of hope, people gathering here really to speak out for so many in Latin America who have been silenced by the violence of these graduates of the School of the Americas.
Can you talk about the arrests? I was there last year, and in the end, the School of the Americas did not arrest anyone. There seemed to be some kind of ritual that went on where the people crossed the line and they were just taken by bus down the street and dropped off. But
yes,
now
sir.
You had 1,700 arrests. What
Let
happened?
Me just say they have a problem. The numbers are increasing every year as we go across the line. People doing this nonviolent civil disobedience, saying, "No, not in our name, will this continue?" And they had to do something this year because every year the numbers get larger. Now, so what they tried to do, what they did this year was detained, you know, arrested 1,700 of us, including Martin Sheen, so many college students, parents, and others. Now, they received a one-year ban and bar letter. And if they return, of course, they will be arrested. Now, among those, some 25 were discovered to have crossed the line last year, and they did say they are going to prosecute those. But I can only say it's a tactic that will not work. We will keep coming back in ever greater numbers here at the main gate until that school is shut down. They've changed the name recently, but this is cosmetic. It's a no name but the same shame. It's still about men with guns.
Let's talk about that for a minute. The school is scheduled to close December 15th, replaced by the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. What is this? Who will run it?
Well, basically, you know, it's still, you know, run by the military. It's a combat school, a little window dressing they've done here. But let me say, nothing really has changed, nothing of substance. It's still about combat, about commando operations, psychological warfare, counterinsurgency. It's still about really training these soldiers to go back to their home countries, like in Guatemala, El Salvador, Colombia, to support a system there, socioeconomic system that keeps a small elite very powerful, very wealthy, and the vast majority are very poor. Also, it provides the muscle, Amy, for the sweatshops, especially in El Salvador and other countries, and protect the policies of the IMF and the World Bank. These soldiers really are the enforcers of the economic giants in Latin America. Let me just say this new name is not fooling anyone. No one was fooled. It's, as I mentioned, a new name with the same shame. It's like taking a bottle of poison and simply writing penicillin on it. It's still deadly, and it simply won't work. We are not going away, of course. We're going to come back in ever greater numbers, and we will keep organizing, working in Congress to cut off the funding to this school.
Father Roy Bourgeois speaking to us from outside the gates of the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, where yesterday more than 1,700 people were arrested, including actor Martin Sheen, who plays the President of the United States on television. Father Roy Bourgeois has been arrested many times as he protests the School of the Americas, the first arrest after Archbishop Oscar Romero was killed in El Salvador, killed by some of those trained at the School of the Americas. Father Roy Bourgeois took the last speech of Oscar Romero before he was assassinated, went on to the Army base and played that speech from a boombox in the trees so that the Salvadoran soldiers who were being trained could hear it in the barracks at night. That speech, paraphrased somewhat, was Oscar Romero pleading with the soldiers of El Salvador. And it said, "I urge you, I plead with you, I order you to put down your arms." You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Brilliant Mistake by Elvis Costello here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, which some might describe what's going on in Florida right now. Republicans and Democrats are facing off in the Florida Supreme Court today in one of the most important rounds in their battle to win the U.S. presidential election. The seven judges of the court are due to start hearing arguments from the campaigns of Republican George Bush, Democrat Al Gore at 2 p.m. today on whether post-deadline results from hand recounts should be added to the Florida total for the November 7th election. Gore is pinning his hopes of wresting Florida from Bush on the possibility that manual recounts of 1.7 million votes in three heavily Democratic counties will boost him into the lead. The Texas governor has a slim lead over Gore of 930 votes out of 6 million cast in the state. Well, over the past 2 weeks since Election Day, we've been hearing about how entire communities in Florida were disenfranchised in one way or the other. Hundreds of thousands of people, many African Americans, who are barred from voting for a lifetime because of criminal records, communities that were targeted for police traffic checks and other forms of intimidation on Election Day. The people turned away because their names did not appear on lists, despite the fact they had registered to vote. Well, we're joined right now by Stacey Powers. She is a White woman, former cop, news director of WTMP, an AM radio station in Tampa. On election day, she traveled around city neighborhoods providing regular news reports to her station. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Stacey Powers.
Good morning.
Can you tell us what happened, what you saw on election day?
Well, you know, I think it's important to touch on the fact that the day prior to election, there was 1,400 absentee ballots in Hillsborough County alone that were rejected, and I reported on that. I did obtain a list of 971 of those registered votes that were rejected for various reasons, the majority being that they were placed in the envelope in the wrong direction. We were advised that those voters could not go to the polls the next day to vote, that their absentee ballot that had been rejected was, in fact, their final vote. So I broke that story on Monday. The following day, when I went to the polls, one of the six precincts that I covered, we covered 14 all in all, and I covered six of those 14. One of the locations, a numerous amount of voters were turned away. They were waiting for me when I arrived there and went in, and we went in together, and we challenged their right to vote on that day. They were all African American, and they were all rejected. They were not given the opportunity to challenge the vote. They were told they had to go to the supervisor of elections office, and I then told the voter registration people, no, we challenge it, and they will be voting here, right here and now today. And I was asked to leave, quote-unquote, not to get snippy and leave. So from there, I went to another location, and that is where I saw a 67-year-old gentleman. He was so proud. He came up to me and advised me he had just voted for the very first time in his life. And he had his little stick on that he had voted. And I asked him, why did you wait so long to vote? And he told me how back in the days that the black people were not allowed to vote. And he, even when he had been given the opportunity and his civil right to vote, he never thought his vote would count. But he felt that he needed to go and vote in this general election, so he did. And we spoke for several moments, and then he left. He was walking with a cane. He was dressed in what appeared to be a Sunday church suit. He was very proud. He was very proud. And I left approximately maybe 7-8 minutes later, and there was only one entrance into that polling site and one entrance out. And when I reached the entrance out, stopped at the stop sign, I turned to my right, and I saw that he had made it all the way to the corner where the stop sign was at, and I waved to him. I was just getting ready to make my right-hand turn when a county sheriff patrol car pulled up onto the grass. Two deputies jumped out and started to harass this man by asking him for identification. He had said, they said, what are you doing in this area? What are you over here for? And he said, I just voted, and he showed his little sticker that they had given him. And they said, we don't care about that. Let's see some driver's license right now. And they were very loud to this gentleman, and he was trying to explain, sir, I didn't do anything. I just voted. And the officer turned to me and said, you know, yelled, what are you waiting for? And at that point, reflex, I just made my right-hand turn, and I watched as I went down the road. This guy put his hands up in the air, and he was visibly upset. You know, he was... It was like a gesture, what's going on? And the officers were continuously, what appeared to be yelling at him.
Stacey Powers, you told your story along with a score of witnesses before the NAACP hearings last weekend. How much news coverage did it get?
On a local level here in Hillsborough County, very little, if any. It was touched on briefly. Accurately, I can't say whether or not it was... let me reiterate there. I'm sure they covered it as accurately as they could, but they did not focus on it being an issue of racial profiling. There were scores of deputy patrol cars in that area. It was just unbelievable, and there have been numerous complaints launched on a local level to the NAACP here, as well as reports filed on Friday through the Justice Department on a national level for the problems that were found to be in the Progress Village Center in Hillsborough County.
I'm looking at my co-host Juan Gonzalez's article that he wrote on Friday in the New York Daily News, Real Vote Victims, Minorities. He says Black and Hispanic leaders have insisted ever since Election Day that gross violations of the Voting Rights Act occurred all over the state, yet the Justice Department and the media keep ignoring the allegations. Congress passed the act specifically to dismantle the Jim Crow laws, including poll taxes and literacy tests that kept blacks from voting in the South for most of the 20th century. Yet here is a presidential election that may be swayed because federal law was violated in one state. Section 11A, the Voting Rights Act, says no person acting under color of law shall fail or refuse to permit any person to vote who's otherwise qualified to vote or willfully fail or refuse to tabulate, count, and report such person's vote. Nothing like that happened in Florida, you say? Well, listen to these accounts. And then he quotes some of your accounts as you watched people harassed on Election Day. So what's happening now, and what kind of response have you gotten to your reports on your local commercial station, WTMP?
Locally, we've gotten numerous complaints, and there's a variety of complaints. I think the two complaints that I had that were most appalling was Staff Sergeant in the Marine Corps that went to vote in uniform and was denied because he did not carry his picture ID with him. He went home to get that picture ID. When he returned, it was 15 minutes before 7 o'clock, and he was still denied the right to vote because the lady told him the polls are closing in 15 minutes, and you don't have time to vote. Other reports that I got that were somewhat disturbing, people that had registered to vote through a 1-800-YES number received their cards in the mail, and these are first-time voters, went to the polls to vote with their picture ID, with their voter registration, saw their name on the list. They were refused the right to vote because their voter's registration listed them as Caucasian when, in fact, they were black. I think there were thousands of people that were affected by this nationally, and I must say this, on a national level, there has been some attention focused on this story here in Hillsborough County, and I believe it's widespread. It goes from county to county. This is not an isolated incident. But there has not been enough focus on the fact that the blacks and the Hispanics were denied their right to vote. If there was a statewide recount done, statewide, there would be no question in my mind, and I say this with very strong belief, that Al Gore would be so far ahead that Bush wouldn't be able to get even near the votes he had. But they're just focusing on, just a very few counties.
And yet if the Voting Rights Act were being enforced, that would be the Clinton-Gore Justice Department that would weigh in here. We're talking about violations of a federal act.
A lot of these, and I must say, a lot of these violations that have occurred, on a local level, I am probably the only one reporting this just as honestly as anyone can. On a local level, there's a lot of people that are intimidated and frightened and are not stepping forward.
Did you start getting tailed by police after you started filing these reports?
8 to 10 minutes after I reported it, and I had to go through a chain of command to find out just how to report this. I knew from being a police officer that it does not take the excessive amount of police vehicles that were out there to supposedly cover a burglary. This is what they have said. I have not seen the burglary report.
They said they were telling you? Because
no, they. What happened was that when I made the report that there was an overabundance of deputies in that area, within 8 to 10 minutes afterwards, they were following me.
So how did you feel as a former cop yourself seeing what police officers were doing?
Well, let me be very honest with you. It surprised me, yet it didn't. It surprised me that the fact that that any law enforcement agency would have went to that extent. However, being a former police officer, I've seen it on the force before, not in Tampa, but where I was a police officer. As far as a lot of prejudice.
And we haven't even talked about Duval County, where supposedly something like 26,000 ballots have been invalidated, particularly high rate of invalidation in black communities in Duval County. We're talking about in the range of a third of their votes invalidated.
It's staggering, and I think that it would be that way statewide if someone would just open their eyes and take time to an initiative to do something.
Well, Stacey Powers, I want to thank you for being with us. Stacey Powers is the news director at a commercial radio station in Tampa, Florida, WTMP AM Radio. Thank you. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, well, it looks like the dictator of Peru, Fujimori, is no longer there, is in Japan with his 30 suitcases and may well be set to resign. We're going to speak with the mother of a U.S. prisoner in Lima, Peru. Rhoda Berenson will be joining us. And then we're going to go to Madrid, where police attacked anti-fascist demonstrators yesterday on the 25th anniversary of the death of Francisco Franco. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, the Peruvian dictator Alberto Fujimori, besieged by an escalating corruption scandal surrounding his fugitive ex-spy chief and confidant, Vladimiros Matosinhos, announced in a written statement early today he'll resign within 48 hours. His decision took into account the fact that opposition lawmakers have won control of the Peruvian Congress. It did not elaborate, the statement didn't, but a motion was before the 120-seat legislature to remove Fujimori as president on constitutional grounds of, quote, moral incapacity. The second vice president, Ricardo Marquez, said yesterday he's ready to assume the presidency and lead Peru to special elections in April. We're joined right now by Rhoda Berenson, who's a retired professor of physics from Nassau Community College. Since November of 1995, she and her husband Mark have devoted their lives to securing the release of their daughter, Lori Berenson, from the Peruvian prison system. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Rhoda Berenson has just published a book called Lori, My Daughter Wrongfully Imprisoned in Peru. Well, you follow Peruvian politics perhaps more closely than anyone in the United States outside of the U.S. government, which is intimately tied to the Peruvian government. What is the latest you've heard about Fujimori and his 30 suitcases?
I think you covered it, that he's in Japan and not expected to return to Peru. I think the big question is who will actually assume this temporary presidency. There is going to be a new election in April, and I think we have to wait and see.
And the opposition Congress, the significance of Congress, of the opposition in Congress taking over for the first time in 10 years from Fujimori?
Well, I think all of this is incredible, and for the Peruvian people, certainly, and Lori has, as I ended my book, just to give you an idea, was when I ended it when Fujimori announced that he was going to step down. At the time, he was thinking of staying a year, though, and as it said, if I can read, my first thought was, wow, and my second thought was, how will this affect Lori? And again, I recall Lori's words that she will, quote, never lose the hope and confidence that there will be a new day of justice in Peru, unquote. And the question is, is this the start of a new day? And will there soon be democracy and social justice for the Peruvian people and freedom for Lori? And as I end it, only time will tell, but I certainly think this is a very positive step.
And where is Vladimiro Montesinos, the shady spy chief who was his closest aide, who was forced out, went to Panama, then apparently came back to Peru, very close to the U.S. government, supposedly on some intelligence payrolls, we believe involved with drug running and other issues. Where is he now?
Well, he might be hiding under your table. I'm not sure. There are reports that he's in Bolivia.
Also in Peru, being shielded by the military?
Possibly. It's a big question mark.
Well, we are almost at the fifth anniversary of the arrest of your daughter, Lori. Mm-hmm. Your book has just come out, Lori, mm-hmm. My Daughter Wrongfully Imprisoned in Peru. Tell us what happened on November 30th, 1995.
Well, the phone rang, actually, for me on December 1st, which is the day after Lori's arrest. It was the Peruvian... the U.S. Embassy in Peru telling me that Lori was arrested, that she would be tried for treason, that I needed to get a Peruvian lawyer, that the president of Peru, the infamous Mr. Fujimori, was seen waving her passport and calling her a North American terrorist on Peruvian television, and my life turned totally upside down and has not returned right side up since.
So Lori was tried in Peru, charged with being a leader of the rebel group, the MRTA, and sentenced to life in prison.
We don't even use the word tried because that brings to mind a trial, and there was no trial. So we say she was arrested and she was sentenced, which is really what happened. And this August, the end of August, August 28th, in fact, the military tribunals, which had sentenced her, said, hey, you know, we made a mistake. Lori was not the leader of a rebel group. They nullified her sentence and nullified her conviction. But then the civilian terrorism courts took up her case, and she's now still in prison and going to be given another show trial.
So tell us where this stands right now. You had Lori, who was first held at the Anamayo prison when she was going to be there for life. Wardens switched out every 6 months because of the health problems they face in such a high-altitude prison. Moved down to Socabaya prison. Then tell us the course of events that led us to the Chirios prison in Lima, where she is now.
Well, she was in Socabaya prison, which was not quite as cold as the Anamayo prison, but where Lori was basically in solitary confinement most of the time, and that was very difficult. And she remained there until the beginning of September. About a year before that, Lori had filed a petition to have her case reviewed. There was evidence provided by members of the Peruvian government who said they knew that Lori was not a leader of a rebel group, that her sentence should be annulled. And that's exactly what happened. And then she was moved to Lima. She's presently in prison in Lima. The prosecutor in her case just asked for an extension of time to find evidence because the time she's had has not provided her with evidence that Lori is guilty, and we know that's true because Lori's not guilty. Lori's innocent, has said so since the day of her arrest, and the prosecutor is sort of scrounging around looking for something that they could pin on her.
And right now, who is the prosecutor and the judge, the administrative judge, that's questioning her? Who is her lawyer, because you've switched lawyers?
Well, the system there has what's called an instructional judge at the moment and a fiscal. These are not the same people who will appear if this goes into an open court. But both of these people are temporary appointees, meaning that they were probably appointed by Mr. Montesinos. There is a part of the horrendous lack of justice in Peru comes from the fact that The executive branch, Mr. Montesinos and Mr. Fujimori, appointed the judges and prosecutors and therefore controlled the justice system. And we know that the present prosecutor and judge are temporary appointees, meaning that they have their job at the will of the executive. Mm-hmm. And the lawyer, we have a new lawyer, not the same one we had 5 years ago, Dr. Sandoval, who we're very pleased with, who has done human rights-type work. And he's following very carefully the human rights violations in Lori's case right now. Not the old ones from the horrendous military courts, but the violations right now. And we have a case at the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights because of the lack of due process.
And what's happening with that?
Well, we know that the commission has told Peru that they need to show why they're keeping Lori in prison. This is a case right now of double jeopardy because Lori was had her sentence annulled and she's being retried on the same actions that were nullified, where her verdict was nullified. And we're waiting for a response from Peru to the commission. The commission has said, show us why Lori is still being held.
One of the things when I went down and saw Lori in March of 1999 when she was at the Socabaya prison with a human rights delegation led by Blaise Bonpain at the Office of the Americas, one of the things that most struck me about Lori is how much she would not talk about her own case and focus much more on the condition of the prisons and that people face in Peru. When the interview was played with Lori in Peru, that was about the time that she had just moved to the Chirios prison in Lima. Did prisoners in that prison hear Lori speaking on the radio?
I assume they did because Lori heard herself speaking on the radio. Of course, it was in English, and I don't know if they translated it or not. And Lori actually found it strange to be listening to herself on the radio. But Lori has a lot of support amongst, I have lots of support when I go to visit the prison from other prisoners' families who tell me they're with us. The other prisoners now all see Lori, prisoners she's never met or don't know her, see Lori as opening a door. And I think that's one of the things that's really helping Lori in this new trial is that it's not just that she's going through this new horrendous trial, but that her whole situation is opening a door for others to have their cases looked at least, for her to be able to, as I know she has, when she gave her testimony, talk about the torture that she either heard about or saw while she was being held. So this is Lori's goal, is not just to, certainly she wants out, for out of there, but also to be able to highlight what happens to others.
We're talking to Rhoda Berenson. Lori, My Daughter Wrongfully Imprisoned in Peru is the name of her book. What has been the role of the U.S. government? And it's looking right through to now. You may have a new leader in Peru as well as a new leader in the United States.
We have a large question mark ahead of us for both of those reasons. And at least we thought that by now we would know who the new leader in the United States was going to be. We don't know right now either one. And, we're in a wait and see. But we know that whatever it is, we now have thousands of and thousands of people across the country who are going to stick with us, who are going to either petition President Gore or President Bush, however it works, on Lori's behalf. They're going to write letters to the new head of the Peruvian government, whoever that is. The support that we've gotten from around the country and around the world, actually, has been absolutely enormous. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was to gather even more support to tell Lori's story in a way that was impossible to do in just sound bites or brief articles in the newspaper, and also because the many people around the country who have been supportive, you know, want to know more. And I hope that the book will give a fuller picture, not just of Lori, but, you know, I think Lori in the book represents many other people. And if I just, you know, I just want to point out to, because you started the show with what's happening down at Fort Benning, that the book is dedicated to all those who, upon recognizing injustice, refuse to remain silent. And that's not just Lori. I hope that the people who read this will realize that there are many people like Lori who refuse to remain silent.
In fact, you have an introduction to the book by Noam Chomsky, who talks about how not only Lori has been subjected to a travesty of justice and a grim exercise of state terror, but he talks about how the victim in this case is a young North American woman of remarkable courage and integrity who's chosen to accept the fate of all too many others in Peru. Mm-hmm. Lori, who went to the same school that Chomsky is a professor at, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I wanted to play just an excerpt of the interview with Lori, March 99, that we only recently played here on Democracy Now! Because we were afraid that she or others would be in danger if we played it when she was still at the Socabaya prison, where we had secretly recorded this interview. And this is Lori a year ago describing what was going on for her.
I think it's a way of delaying it. I mean, civilian trials in Peru also can last 6 years. In my case, at this point, with such publicity that I've had, such negative publicity that I've had in Peru, I would never get a fair trial.
Lori Berenson made these comments a year and a half ago when I joined a human rights delegation headed by Blaise Bonpain of the Office of the Americas in Los Angeles and Reverend Lucius Walker of Pastors for Peace in New York. We went to Peru in March of 1999, flew to the Socabaya prison where Berenson had spent 150 days in solitary confinement. Today, for the first time, you'll hear Lori Berenson speak about prison conditions, her hopes for the future, the charges she faced as a leader of the MRTA, the rebel group in Peru that would, a year later, take over the Japanese ambassador's residence. The comments are excerpts of a longer interview screened by Lori Berenson's parents and her lawyer, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. We began by talking about the Yanomayo prison, where Lori has spent the first, well, 2 to 3 years of her life. The prison is in the Andes with extremely high mountains where wardens are rotated out every 6 months to deal with the altitude, but prisoners can remain there their entire lives.
In Yanomayo, the coldness is a pretty, more than it's the coldness in itself, it's the fact that there are different certain circumstances that exacerbate the situation in which one feels, you know, like the climate, people, the harassment, the sense of, you know, they used to send in the special forces of the police and they actually hit
In case you have any trouble understanding what Lori is saying, she said the authorities used to send in the special forces of the police and whack people on the head. She also said the authorities felt she had proved her guilt by raising concerns first about jail conditions and only then about her own case.
I have a difficult time saying, well, I, you know, deal with me, you know,
yeah.
Forget about the rest of them, they're dying, you know, I can't do that. That would be off the wall.
Lori Berenson, speaking from prison in 1999, you know, she wasn't allowed for 5 years. Her voice could not be heard outside of the interpretation of her case by the Peruvian government. Rhoda Berenson, our guest, as we wrap up here today, has just come out with a book on her daughter, Lori, My Daughter Wrongfully Imprisoned in Peru. What has your education been like, and what has this been like for you? You have two daughters. You're a physics professor at Nassau Community College. You just retired to devote yourself totally to freeing Lori.
Oh, this has been a huge education. It's very unlike teaching or studying physics, that's for certain. There's a certain lack of logic in dealing in the world of diplomacy that took a lot of getting used to. And I, as you said, I probably know as much about the Peruvian government as our government knows, or even more, I think, sometimes. It's a whole other life, even just writing a book. I mean, this is not what I would have ever imagined I would be doing. But, as you just pointed out, Laurie's voice wasn't heard for 5 years. And when I started writing the book, Laurie's voice wasn't heard at all. And part of my goal was to have her voice heard through the book, through the letters that she sent to me or to many others. And if I could just read one, which a lot of people ask, you know, how does Laurie remain so strong? And her letters, I think, show it. When she was up in Llanamayo prison, up in the city of Puno, where it was so cold and so awful, the letter that she wrote to Leo Wood from Vermont, who's an octogenarian supporter who's out there in all kinds of weather rooting for Laurie. Anyway, she wrote, "The sky of Puno is an intense blue, very beautiful, as it is in all of the Altiplano. But what is most beautiful about this sky is that it doesn't belong to anyone. Yet, at the same time, it belongs to everyone. The whole nation, the whole continent, the whole planet. And so does peace, dignity, and liberty." And it's thoughts like that that keep Laurie strong.
And I'll end with the end of your book. It's Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States. I saw him on Saturday night at a celebration of Native American culture as he was again talking about Laurie Berenson. He ends this book, also Laurie's attorney here in the United States, by saying that this book is about two remarkable women and what they did. Though the voice is nearly always Rhoda's, Laurie is present in every page, and the book tells the story. Laurie and Rhoda may seem more like sisters in appearance, interests, and the way they act toward one another, but this history is powerful support for the old adage that your mother is the best friend you ever have. Not that Laurie's sister Kathy and father Mark haven't been heroic too. Their stories will have to wait for another book. But it's hard to believe that any other relationship could have brought forth the mutual strength, faith, support, laughs, and determination that these two generate in each other. Laurie loves her doctor of numbers, a known statistician and educator, passionately. And Mark would make any sacrifice for Laurie and has sacrificed at least as much as Rhoda. But when the worst crisis came, it was Rhoda's presence that turned shared anguish into laughter and relief and transformed the sense of powerlessness that often overwhelms in time of maximum peril into belief that we shall overcome and thus can the human spirit prevail and Laurie will be free. Well, we will see what happens with Laurie. But right now, the story of Laurie Berenson is told in a new book, Laurie, My Daughter Wrongfully Imprisoned in Peru. And it goes beyond that, though. It goes to the thousands of people who have been wrongfully imprisoned in Peru. And thank you very much, Rhoda Berenson, for writing it.
Thank you.
The book is published by Context Publishers here in New York. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And more information on the Laurie Berenson case, you can go to the website www.freelaurie.org. We'll be back in a minute in Madrid, Spain, and find out why police attacked anti-fascist protesters yesterday on the 25th anniversary of the death of Francisco Franco. Stay with us.
Ah, y por donde quiera aunque el cielo te guíe, Dios te dé fortuna. Yo
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Spanish police charged against anti-fascist demonstrators in Madrid yesterday on the 25th anniversary of the death of Francisco Franco, Western Europe's longest reigning dictator of the 20th century. 40 people were injured, 7 were arrested. The demonstrators were countering a fascist rally that praised Franco's leadership of Spain. When police began to club them with batons and shoot rubber bullets, demonstrators say the police also fired live ammunition as warning shots. Franco ruled Spain with an iron fist after unleashing one of the continent's most bitter civil wars. In 1936, he led a revolt against the democratically elected Republican government, sparking the Spanish Civil War, in which over 500,000 people were killed. The war attracted volunteer combatants from all over the world, known as the International Brigadiers, who joined the Republicans in their fight against fascism. A number of those International Brigadiers from the United States. Franco assigned to himself the title of El Caudillo, or the Supreme Leader, a concept that served as a model for Latin American dictatorships, such as Augusto Pinochet's in Chile. We're going to turn first to Andrea Comas, who is a freelance photographer covering the demonstrations for Reuters, speaking to us from Madrid. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Andrea.
Hello.
Hi. Can you tell us what happened yesterday?
Well, people were demonstrating, and almost at the end of the demonstration, suddenly, I don't know why, the police started with going after the demonstrators with clubs and rubber bullets. And I didn't see what started exactly the incident, but I suddenly saw a lot of people around me on the floor and a lot of people with blood in their head. And just like 100 or 200 policemen running after them. And that's when demonstrators started, throwing bottles and stones at the riot police.
Did you get hurt, Andrea?
Yeah. I didn't notice that something was going on because everything was very quiet. And I thought, well, this is over. And suddenly I was on the floor because I got hurt with a club on my back.
How many protesters were there yesterday?
About 3,000.
3,000 anti-fascist. How many fascists?
How many fascists? I think 3,000, more or less, too, because there were 2 fascist protests.
But the police didn't move in on them?
No, they never do. The thing is that right from the beginning, from the anti-fascist demonstration, almost all the photographers who were there, we knew that something was going to happen because the police were surrounding them right from the beginning. And showing them like the clubs and this rubber bullets, so like almost provoking them. So we were all a little bit scared at the beginning, but later on we forgot about it because everything went on pretty quiet.
Well, Andrea, we're going to introduce George Sosenko now. After the war in 1939, hundreds of women and men decided not to abandon their fight against fascism, and they remained in the mountains as guerrillas. They became known popularly as the Maquis. Most were killed by Franco's civil guards. Many also abandoned the armed struggle in 1947 when the socialists voted to leave the movement. The guerrillas and the International Brigadiers are still officially listed in Spain as bandoleros or bandits. Just this month, about 40 of them traveled by bus through Spain in the Caravan of Remembrance to remind Spain about the significance of their fight against fascism and to get support for a law changing their current status as bandits. We're joined now by George Sosenko, who was a French international brigadier who signed up to fight against Franco when he was 16 years old. He spent this past month touring in Spain as part of this caravan and speaks to us now from Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to Democracy Now!, George Sosenko.
Yes, this is George Sosenko. What happened that we, the generation...
Can you speak as loud as you can? We have a very bad connection. If you could, can you speak much louder into
louder,
the telephone?
Yes, I can speak louder.
Excellent.
It's okay like that?
Much better. Even closer if you can.
Okay. What happened that the generation who grew up in between both wars, we were much more concerned about the destiny of the world. And we could see that the fascism was taking over. And when Franco invaded the country from Africa, Franco came from Africa because he didn't recognize the legally elected Republican government in Spain. And so in France, we decided that we needed to help the democracy. And without any communication with other countries, we went to fight. I was 16 years old. I crossed the border from France, and I went to join the Republican Army in the Durruti Column in Aragon. And I learned later on that we were volunteer from 52 different nations without knowing each other, without communication, without any arrangement. We just came spontaneously to fight for the democracy, and the democracy, or so-called democracy of the country, like France, England, and the United States, they just were so scared of Hitler and Mussolini that they didn't help the Spanish Republic, and they let Germany and Italy send arms and soldiers to fight against us. And that was how the Spanish Civil War ended, with the defeat of the Republican, with the Spanish Republican. Now, if we could have avoided this defeat, and if the democracy had enough guts to help us to fight the fascists, we could have avoided this World War II, where we lost 56 million people, and also to have the shameful situation of the Holocaust, where people were killed. Roosevelt, at the end of his life, said that his biggest blunder, it was not to recognize the Spanish Republic and not to help them. Now, time is running out of the 42,000 brigadistas from all over the world, from 52 countries that we went to fight in Spain. We are barely 400 alive, 120 in the United States, and we have a message. It's very important for us to give the message to the young generation. That's why Dolores Cabra, she initiated this Caravana de la Memoria, with the Caravan of the Memory, traveling through all Spain for 5 weeks with 40 of us. We were three brigadistas. We were several guerrilleros, the partisans, who kept on fighting in Spain against Franco, and some of them who crossed the border in 1939 when the Republic had been defeated and the French put them in a concentration camp. And when the Germans invaded France, they went to join the French partisans fighting against the fascism. We have also something that we disregard or we ignore completely, that 140,000 children in Spain have been sent overseas to protect them against the horror of the war, because Franco, in the first 6 months when he occupied Spain, he shot, he slaughtered 500,000 people, innocent people, throwing them in common fosses. And the parents were desperate and sent his children. 70,000 of them went to Russia, who in World War II also went to fight against the fascism in the Red Russian Army. Many went to Mexico, who really was one of the most wonderful countries, receiving these children and helping the Spanish Republic. The purpose of the caravana was to go to the places where the Spanish people suffer, where Franco made atrocities, slaughtering close to the cemeteries, and we were lecturing the university, talking with the people who received us very warmly and with open arms. As a matter of fact, I finished to write my memories, and I'm looking for a publisher. It's about all my life that I have been struggling against the fascism.
George Shashenko, we are also joined on the line by Adelina Kondratieva. She is a brigadier from Russia who worked as a translator for Republican Air Force during the Civil War. She's going to be translated by our producer, Maria Carrion. We're speaking to her in Madrid. Adelina Kondratieva, welcome to Democracy Now! Why did you go to Spain during the Civil War?
Adelina Kondratieva, muy bienvenida a Democracy Now! ¿Por qué fue usted a España a luchar en la Guerra Civil?
Pues es una historia un poco larga.
It's a little long
pero
story.
Trataré de una forma breve explicarla.
I'll try to briefly explain it.
Cuando la Unión Soviética empezó a suministrar armamento,
when the Soviet Union began to give armament,
surgió la necesidad de tener traductores con conocimiento del español y el ruso para poder facilitar.
There was a need for translators to translate from Russian to Spanish to facilitate
la coordinación de las diferentes operaciones.
The coordination of different operations.
Llegaron a España junto con el armamento, asesores, consejeros.
So advisors were sent along with armament.
Aviadores, tanquistas, artilleros.
Artillery experts and pilots and other experts.
Was it unusual for a woman to come, like you?
¿Era inusual que, por ejemplo, una mujer como usted fuera hasta España, que una mujer fuera?
Usual, no. Era el deseo de ayudar, el deseo de participar en la lucha contra el fascismo.
It wasn't usual, but it was a desire to participate in the fight against fascism, to fight.
En esa lucha encarnizada contra la fuerza grosera, la fuerza del fascismo, contra un país, contra un Estado, contra un pueblo que había elegido su propio camino, la República.
It was a desire to fight in this bloody war that was brought on by the fascists and that tried to force a different government onto people who had democratically elected their own government.
Do you think there's a chance we could get a song from the two of you from the Spanish Civil War that you might sing for us as we wrap up the program? George, any thought of a song?
Sí, María.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes.
Maria.
Can we go out with a song from the Spanish Civil War that the two of you could sing?
Adelina, Amy está preguntando si ambos de ustedes pueden cantar un poquito, una estrofa de alguna canción de la Guerra Civil.
No, la canción. Ay, Carmela, ay, Carmela. No, pero las canciones hay que tener. María, por favor, hay que tener un poco de voz.
We have to have a little bit of voice to sing.
Okay.
Y en estos momentos después
they're exhausted after the caravan.
Y de la caravana y todo lo que hemos hecho.
And
y
I know
nuestra organización.
And I know the protests of yesterday were very difficult. I want to thank Adelina Kondratieva, a brigadier from Russia who worked as a translator for the Republican Air Force during the Civil War, and George Shashenko, who spent this month in Spain as part of the Caravan of Remembrance, speaking to us from Atlanta, Georgia. That does it for the program today. Special thanks to Maria Carrion, our producer, Matthew Finch, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.